Welcome to Booked, where two guys tell you about the books they're reading. I'm Rob Olson.
And I'm Livia Snedden. This week's book is long awaited. So a little bit of backstory. Rob and I found out about this in Minneapolis last year. Probably wasn't a huge secret then, but we were kind of told not to talk about it publicly.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure we bragged about it vaguely on the podcast.
Oh, yeah. So. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Listen, we deal with a lot of writers, and there's a lot of vague comments and stuff. So we get to do it. We just do it on here, not on social media. So so we've been waiting 14 months for this.
Yeah.
And it has finally arrived. Now, to be fair, it didn't arrive in our mailboxes, which is why you didn't see pictures of us holding this book up 2 and 3 months ago. Like you may have seen, you know, I don't know, half of Facebook that got advanced reader copies. We had to get ours the old-fashioned way by purchasing them. But we're going to try not to hold that against anybody while we're reviewing this book, I think, right?
Yeah, not while we're reviewing the book. We'll hold it against them like later. Afterwards, and kind of yeah. Like quietly.
Mongrels by Stephen Graham Jones hit the Kindles a week ago from when you're hearing this. Rob and I jumped all over it. Very excited to get into this. Here is a little bit about... It feels like I've read this like 6 or 7 times. Here is the bio from Stephen Graham Jones. Born and raised in Texas, in Boulder, Colorado now, 43, Blackfeet, into werewolves and slashers and zombies. Would wear pirate shirts a lot if I could find them, and probably carry some kind of sword.
Yeah.
That's all you have
definitely, to do. Yeah, that's definitely a Stephen Graham Jones bio. Here's a little bit about the book, Mongrels. A spellbinding and darkly humorous coming-of-age story about an unusual boy whose family lives on the fringe of society and struggles to survive in a hostile world that shuns and fears them. That's one big long sentence right there. He was born an outsider like the rest of his family, poor yet resilient. He lives in the shadows with his Aunt Libby and his Uncle Darren, folk who stubbornly make their way in society that does not understand or want them. They are mongrels, mixed blood, neither this nor that. The boy at the center of the mongrels must decide if he belongs on the road with his aunt and uncle or if he fits with the people on the other side of the tracks. For 10 years, he and his family have lived in a life of late-night exits and narrow escapes, always on the move across the south to stay one step ahead of the law. But the time is drawing near when Darren and Libby will finally know if their nephew is like them or not. And the close calls they've been running from for so long are catching up fast now. Everything is about to change.
Hey, what is the kid's name in this story? That awkward silence is probably the same thing that it just occurred to me, that it's an unnamed protagonist. I'm pretty sure I'm right on this, right?
It is because, and we can talk about this later, but stylistically... In different chapters, he's called different things, like the prisoner, the hitchhiker, things like that.
Yep, the reporter, yep.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me while you were reading this, I was like, I want to talk about this kid, and I don't know what to call him. And then I realized it's not in the synopsis, although they named the aunt and the uncle. Plenty other characters with names in the book.
Yeah.
We start off with an 8-year-old protagonist. Who is basically kind of recounting what's going on in his life currently through maybe a series of stories or things his grandfather says and or does. Life lessons, tall tales, seemingly that kind of thing. But seems that his grandfather claims to be a werewolf.
Yeah. It starts out ambiguous, so as his grandfather is telling these stories, it's presented as just a crazy grandfather who's telling crazy grandfather stories just to get a rise out of people. What does he say? Talk him around the house or something like that? Talking people around the house?
Yep.
But it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. You don't really think it's actually like he's claiming to be a real-life werewolf. But as the grandfather stories go on, it becomes less vague and more specific. And so you start to think, hey, maybe he is just actually talking about being a real werewolf.
Yeah. So it doesn't take us long into the book to get to the fact that, Yes, some of those stories are true. Maybe some are a little embellished, but the werewolf stuff is definitely true. As our young protagonist finds out very early on at the age of 8 or so. And then we have kind of a weird progression in this book because it kind of time jumps back and forth a little bit, but from a really kind of weird small time frame.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes from 8 to like 13, back to 8 to like 14, back to 8 to like 14, back to 8 to like 15. I mean, it's kind of a, you know, we see the kid at 8 and 9. And those portions are told third person. Although you still get the feeling. Yeah, you still get the feeling that it's the narrator telling you this, but that's kind of what we talked about, where in those particular throwback chapters, we'll call them, or I'll call them, I guess, Rob, call them whatever he wants. He refers to himself as whatever thing he's feeling and or doing at the time. So at one point, he's the journalist, I think is what it was. Maybe it's not the reporter. But yeah, at one point, he is kind of describing himself as a prisoner. And these are all kind of tongue-in-cheek. Though the reporter or journalist one was, he was supposed to be interviewing a family member. So during that whole kind of flashback, throwback chapter, he's referring to himself as, and I forget, I guess I think it was the reporter, you know, because he's supposed to kind of get this story from a family member, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of move forward. But really, the vast majority of his book, 90-ish percent, maybe a little less than that, he is fully aware that he is a part of a family of werewolves. But he has an interesting issue because he might be a late-blooming werewolf. Or he might not actually have gotten that particular gene or the blood, as they call it, in this. So he's not really clear on if he's ever going to be a werewolf or not.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot, I think, to talk about the way the book is structured. But picking up from Livius's point, the lore that you pick up is that, for the most part, you have your first kind of transformation as a werewolf, usually in your early teens. I think both Libby and Darren said theirs was around the age of 12. So a lot of this book takes place where our main character is beyond the age of 12 and wondering if he's ever going to become a werewolf. And you also discover throughout the telling of this story that just being born from someone who's a werewolf doesn't necessarily mean you will be one. There's a chance that you don't get that gene or whatever you want to say it is. So there is like rock solid uncertainty. Like there is no guarantee that at some point he's going to transform, but he's growing up and living his life with these werewolves. And these are the only people that he cares about and admires and looks up to. So of course he wants to experience that, but, maybe not everybody wants him to. Maybe I know that his aunt kind of is thinking that if he doesn't have that werewolf thing going on, that maybe he can have a chance at living a more normal life. So it's a story about a kid growing up, and he wants to be like, you know, like his role models, but some do, and some, you know, there's like a back and forth about whether it's a good thing, because one thing you learn very quickly and is emphasized throughout the book is that the werewolf life is not glamorous or money filled. It's basically kind of shitty. It's going from place to place, hiding, running, never having money, losing jobs, you know, being chased, being threatened and stuff like that. So, the idea of him maybe having a non-werewolf life, might be a little easier.
Yeah. One of the things that was done brilliantly, one of quite a few things that was done very brilliantly, is it seems that of late, and I'm not going to say this is across the board, so I don't need anyone to correct me on this, but a lot of the bigger vampire and werewolf fiction always has this kind of convenience of, you know, there's a lot of money, and there's, you know, like, you were kind of in this place, and we've totally set up protection for ourselves, and, you know, we have these great disguises or whatever, you know, personas that we... Yeah, that's definitely not in this book. This takes, you know, a super being, a supernatural being, I guess, and you know, turns him into kind of the gypsy transient type thing. And it's There's a lot of things we learn all werewolves do, and all werewolves go from place to place, and they basically have to stay, you know, in the southern states to avoid things like wolf prints in the snow and shit like that. I mean, so there's a lot of really well thought out, really down to earth. If werewolves were real, this seems far more likely than maybe some of the other things. When we read...
Last Werewolf and Tallulah Rising,
right,
and all that.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Glenn Millionaire, Duncan stuff.
Butler, security, access to helicopters, right? That's what it was, because he'd been around for a long time. And, you know, it's kind of same thing. Twilight, the werewolves were all part of the Indian reservation, but they had their own built-in kind of security. Like, they were safe as long as they stayed amongst their own people. There is none of that here. There aren't your own people. You have a family. You know, basically the people in your immediate vicinity that you live with, and that's it. And it seems to me that at least that was in this book. And I believe at one point he said it, you know, the movies have it all wrong with packs. Really, it's just about your blood family.
Yeah, and the cool thing that that does is, I mean, first of all, it takes away all, I guess, worldly power from them, and all their power comes from within. And so, first of all, you see... it's all about survival. And so you see how a werewolf can endure and how they adapt to survive and everything like that. But it brings about a whole lot of pride as well. Where, like, if they'll come out in a quote. I have a great quote that I don't have handy right now about there's this one thing that happens throughout the book where our protagonist, if... someone says something about him or one of his family, or they say something about themselves where it's like, I'm this, or they are that. In his mind, mentally, he corrects them to the, no, I'm a werewolf, or no, they're a werewolf. And there's a lot of, like, that's the only thing really that he really holds on to, is that the thing that makes him and his aunt and uncle what they are is the fact that they're werewolves. So they lose all their, you know, societal power, social power, but they have all the power of, like, the pride of being family and being werewolves, which is kind of neat.
In some cases, and I don't have anything that comes to mind immediately, but I know I've seen movies, and I don't know if we've read any books, but it's almost like, you know, kind of country of origin pride.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? But interestingly enough, I just realized that there was none assigned to them. They don't, you know what I mean? They're not Irish or Polish or Hispanic or Indian, or, you know, which, again, it's kind of a trope. You know, usually you have a country of designation if you're a werewolf. I mean, in most things that I remember seeing and or reading, there's kind of the ethnic slant to that. So, yeah, interestingly enough, yeah, being a werewolf is what you are. You know, there's so many good things about this book. Because not only do we find out that you're a werewolf, but I mean, some of the most basic things, and some of it goes into spoiler territory. There's some brilliant stuff. This might be, you guys may get a I don't remember what we call it.
Spoiler talk.
Yeah. Spoiler talk episode after this, because there's really some great stuff in here that transcends the genre, I guess. I don't think that the Jones painted himself any easy outs in this. And I know he's very, very passionate about werewolves. And I'm sure that this has been, you know, building inside him, and that this book has been writing itself for a long, long time. But I can't think of, and you know what, and I love supernatural fiction. I've seen all the werewolf movies. I don't know if I've seen all of them, but you get what I'm saying. I'm very familiar with it. I don't think there's one stone he left unturned through the course of this book. Like, where he has addressed every single thing that's ever been said about werewolves, or at least said in a authoritative enough way, you know, through a movie or a book or something that, you know, that wasn't addressed either as a truth or a not truth, but then given a very solid explanation.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. He's thorough about, and that's the thing, like you said, transcends, and it seems like every book we read from him takes something and does something with it that no one's done before, and this is no exception. Probably, I don't know how far we can talk about story. We've kind of set up the story as best we can, right?
I think we could talk a little bit about Yeah, about the other two characters, because they're very important in his development and to the story, because they're very contrasting characters. So you've got Darren, Uncle Darren, who Darren and Libby and the protagonist's mother were triplets.
Yeah.
His mother died at childbirth, so he doesn't know his mother. So he kind of attaches, and of course, Libby is her twin, so he kind of attaches that maternal thing to her. She's very protective and very reasonable through large portions of the book, but you know, there's times where her temper rises and she, you know, maybe acts out, but she's the one who's trying to kind of keep shit together, you know, looking after him and making sure he has everything he needs. On the flip side, you have his Uncle Darren, who is really a werewolf. Like, he believes in that life. He goes out pretty much nightly and hunts and, you know, and uses his werewolf abilities for, I don't want to say for gain, but in order to provide. Yeah. And Libby doesn't nearly as much. He's far more conservative, while Darren is the kind of outlandish uncle that, you know, is that we've seen and maybe had. I don't have an uncle, but you know what I mean? That crazy kind of uncle that's down for whatever and does all the weird and goofy shit and dangerous stuff. That's Darren.
The bad influence.
Yep. And Libby is, you know, she's far more reserved, and she's the one that's trying to figure out where their next meal is coming from and when they're going to have to skip town, which is every chapter, basically. They have to leave town at some point and move on. In many cases, because of things Darren has done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you learn early on that essentially they can't stay anywhere too long because... as far as how they survive, Libby gets, you know, minimum wage jobs. Darren sometimes works as a truck driver, but for the most part, he hunts for their food. And I think the only non-hunted food that we really see anybody eating for the most part is, like, hot dogs. Hot dogs to actually make a big appearance in this book, a very frequent appearance in this book. But, They're living in the South in different places where a farmer is going to realize that someone's stealing their livestock and then, you know, go after people for it. So they can't stay in one place for too long because they'll get found out. They're the new people that, you know, aren't part of the society, and suddenly all this cattle goes missing or whatever. It, you know, things are going to add up quickly. So they don't stay in one place for too long, or, you know, Darren might freak out and go and cause some ruckus somewhere, and then they have to just up and move in the middle of the night. So, kind of a frequent thing. It's not always Darren, though. Sometimes Libby gets up to some trouble, too.
Yeah, she does. But like I said, hers is almost always reactionary.
Yeah.
Darren just kind of is reckless, maybe. But Libby, yeah, reacts poorly to things at times. But we're also driven to believe that, you know, I don't know, there are things that are catalysts for the wolf coming out. So anytime someone feels threatened or whatever, it's far more likely that there's a transformation. If there's a transformation, somebody's getting fucked up.
It's the bottom line. Yep. And the term wolf out, I like that, wolf out, yep. When you wolf out. I know I'd heard it before I read this book, but I can't remember where, but it just fits so well when you wolf out. Yep. Sprinkled throughout, there are some other minor characters, like Libby's got an ex named Red, who is also a werewolf, who is just a bad person. He makes an appearance from time to time. And so basically everywhere they go, either it's just kind of a vignette of their lives in this existence, or they meet and interact with, you know, a little person here or there. At one point, our protagonist gets something resembling a girlfriend when he's in his high school years. And so there's a chunk of the book that has to do with that. And that's actually probably one of my more favorite parts of the book, is the... when he meets a girl. That was pretty good. But some of the more fascinating things to me are the way that the story is told. So is it okay if I kind of transition to that? Because I got a couple thoughts.
Sure, absolutely. I have some thoughts on this as well.
So we start out, like we said in the beginning of this review, talking about how the grandfather is telling, you know, what sound like outlandish stories, but as time goes on, they become more and more... like less and less crazy, I guess, and more like, oh, he's actually not kidding. And that's the tone of the whole book. It's essentially, when the grandfather is not in the picture, Darren, for the most part, takes up in what's basically the telling of like a verbal history. Like they're teaching our protagonist the lore of werewolves through stories. And there's a lot of reflection and thought about like how this verbal history is told. And this book that we're reading kind of ends up being the printed version of a lot of that verbal history.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's, I love the grandfather stories and how even later in the book, the protagonist relates back, and there are some great quotes, and I'm hoping that if I didn't capture them, you did. There's one that jumps out, and I don't know if I have it marked, but even was it something about lie? Even when he was telling lies, he was telling the truth.
I have that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just brilliant stuff in there, but yeah, it, this goes back a little bit to what I was saying. So a lot of these story, a lot of the stories he's telling cover things like, can a werewolf turn a man into a wolf? You know, that we've seen in other fiction and in movies. The other thing was, you know, could somebody stop being a wolf? You know, and all these things are addressed. And then they go as far as like, the fact that werewolves always take their garbage out at night, because when somebody wolfs out, they would grab the first thing that looks like food, and like things like packaging and tinfoil could kill them.
When they transform back, yeah.
So from all the way from the big questions, right? Like, can they make another werewolf? Down to, hey, you can't eat shit that's like, you know, in certain packages and stuff that's in the trash, because you'll end up hurt or dead. You know what I mean? But yeah, it is told in a series of vignettes. And maybe my only gripe about this book, and again, it's subjective. It's. I think I would have liked maybe a more linear story. There was no real. There was no overarching threat throughout the book. You know what I mean? It was just them on the run, and it was a series of snapshots. And although there were different threats at different points, and you're wondering, hey, how are they going to get out of this particular situation or that situation? Although there were a couple of longer threads, it wasn't a novel so much as a series of interconnected stories.
It's a coming of age story. The conflict is learning how to be a person.
I understand it, and I knew that was likely going to be your comeback to that, which is fine. Like I said, it's totally subjective, and I'm not saying that this should put people off at all. As a matter of fact, I really like this book a lot, but there were times where I kind of felt that I would have liked to have seen kind of the more traditional linear version of Mongrels.
Yeah, I could see why you would say that. But it is, yeah, it does have a lot going on, but in smaller bits. That's why you're saying vignettes, right? Just like there's a little story here, and then there's a story there, and there's a story about someone telling a story, as opposed to like an arc of a plot.
It's interesting. You read the acknowledgments, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that he mentions Knock 'Em Stiff.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about those kinds of books, and there's a few that we read that way. Crimes in Southern Indiana, Knock 'Em Stiff. I think there was something else we read that was kind of that same kind of tone. Because I was thinking about not those books specifically, but that style of writing when I was, you know, when I got to halfway and decided this isn't going to ever become that traditional.
Right, it's more of a threaded,
yep,
short story collection.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, I think that probably going into quotes is going to be the best choice, because you get the idea of the story, and it's more of a layout than like Livia said, kind of the progression of a plot. So we've told you pretty much what you need to know as far as that goes, but I think you're going to get a good idea of the tone of the book from some of the quotes that we have. So I'm going to bring mine up.
I'll go ahead and kick it off, because I mentioned this, and this isn't the exact quote that I mentioned earlier, so maybe Rob has this, but I'm going to take it now. All right, here's the quote to kind of exemplify some of the thoughts he has about his grandfather's stories. And it's one simple sentence: because all of my grandfather's stories were apologies.
Yeah, that killed me, but also, yeah, absolutely, that's an amazing quote. And it ties right in with, I think this is what you were referring to. Chapter 7, The Lone Ranger. Darren was just like Grandpa, telling me one story, meaning another. Is that what you meant?
Yep.
The idea being like the story that he told, you get it, telling one story, meaning another. But like, also, this was his school, was these stories that were being told, I thought was pretty good too.
Mm-hmm. All right. This is from early on in the book, and this we talked about, and it's kind of a thread throughout. So I'm just going to give you the very short version of this. The modern world, it's custom designed to kill werewolves. There's French fries for one. And then it goes into this really long paragraph about how something as inane as French fries could actually cause a werewolf problems.
Oh man, my next quote is gonna completely compliment that. There's a lot of talk, especially at the beginning of the book, about like the things that are dangerous or deadly to werewolves. And he'll kind of explain what it is, and it sounds ridiculous, but then he'll explain it and you're like, oh yeah, I could see where that would be a big problem. So it's obvious that Jones has done a lot of thinking about like, what if I were a werewolf? What would be a danger to me? This quote's really fast, but I'll talk about it a little bit afterwards. Stretch pants are just as dangerous to werewolves as highways. So there's this whole crazy, ridiculous thing about stretch pants and how, like, if you're wearing stretch pants when you wolf out, just really horrible things will happen to you, which you'll have to read the book to understand. But the highways one is really interesting because if you're driving and you wolf out, like, you turn into a wolf behind the wheel of a car, you don't have the required, like, motor skills or even, like, you know, physical form to drive a car.
The ability to grasp a steering wheel, yeah.
Right, right. So, like, no one's probably ever thought about that, but, like, if you wolf out behind the wheel doing 80 on a highway, that's pretty much the end. And stretch pants is one of the more hilarious,
yeah,
dangerous to werewolves.
The entire paragraph that explains it was going to be my next quote, so I'm going to skip over that.
Sorry,
no,
buddy.
It's okay. No, not at all. So the Lone Ranger, Stephen Graham Jones and I have a phenomenal amount of things in common, quite possibly because we're the same age, but I see him on social media and we love a lot of the same old bands. And I get the feeling, now, I don't know, maybe this was a love for the Lone Ranger or he was just forced to watch it. Cause I can tell you here, it was WGN on the weekends. The Lone Ranger might've been the only child friendly thing to watch on a Sunday that wasn't like a, you know, political interviews or something like that. So there's a chapter entitled The Lone Ranger and explains a little bit about how the Lone Ranger was a werewolf. For that last gasp of the Old West, when trains and horses were both there at once, and hand crank movie cameras too, the Lone Ranger was a werewolf, and the worst kind, a self-hating one. A werewolf who hunted down other werewolves, a werewolf too weak to just start with himself.
Man, Jones, dude.
Yeah, a lot of this spoke to me on a personal level. Like I said, because there are a lot of the same things that, you know... Like, did you ever see The Lone Ranger when you were a kid? I mean, was that even...
No, it was... Nope. I'm going to do this one before you get to it, because I have a story that goes along with it. The Chapter 6, Werewolves on the Moon. This is a flashback to when he's younger. I think he's in third grade. And all the kids had to do drawings about what they want to be when they grew up. And he drew an astronaut, but that astronaut just happened to be a werewolf that was killing other astronauts on the moon. And he got in trouble for it, so Libby had to come in and talk to the teacher. And the teacher says, and it's not that I don't appreciate the humor of it, she says, sitting back but keeping the aunt in her teacher stare, if werewolves were real, then of course putting one on the moon would have disastrous effects. And that's hilarious, right?
Absolutely.
Did I text you a picture earlier today?
You did not.
All right, we're going to pause while I text Livius a picture. So I'm going to say right now it is the middle of May, and that's when we're reading this book. And we just got this book last week, right? And we haven't had any previews of this book at all, right?
No, sadly, no.
No, we've been in the dark. We've known of it, but we've never seen it or anything like that. Now, I just sent Livius an image that's going to blow his mind.
Wow. On February 7th, Rob Olson posted on Facebook... If a werewolf went to the moon, what then?
Right?
That's pretty impressive.
Pretty proud of myself there, buddy.
Yeah. I wish some of these comments were as impressive as your original thought.
Yeah, I don't have... I mean, sometimes the quality of our friends... It's actually a bunch of, like... some of them are friends of the podcast.
Yes, three of them are. Anyway, yeah, that's... That's super interesting. But yes,
so me and Steven have a couple of things in common too, I guess.
Apparently, yes. Apparently. this next one is I don't know. The next two I thought were really indicative of the main character's kind of thought process. And since this is pretty much all narrated by him, but like we had said before, some of them kind of first person, or some first person, some kind of weird third person. This is the protagonist is talking to Darren, to his uncle. This is happening during a conversation with his uncle. This is his inner dialogue. I took a bite of my hot dog. Hot dogs are quiet. You can chew them and not miss anything your uncle's about to tell you. So I think it's great because it gives you the mindset of the protagonist. This is the type of inner dialogue or inner monologue, whatever, that he has throughout the course of the book. But I really like this because I thought it was indicative of he absolutely hinges, just hangs on every word that is his uncle says all the time, because he's enamored by his uncle, even though his uncle picks on him and stuff. He idolizes him and he wants to grow up to be a werewolf. And this is his one connection. Libby won't give him a lot of information and tries to kind of shush Darren when he is, you know, kind of imparting anything but absolute safety precautions to him. So I thought that was a really great line. This other one is the same thing, but I just love the concept behind all of this. And I don't know that I'll do it justice without reading up to it. His uncle is telling him something, you know, and he's not always sure what to believe when his uncle says stuff too. So this line is probably my favorite line in the whole book. He told me this over a bowl of vanilla ice cream we were supposed to be splitting, though, so I don't know. Indicating that he didn't know if his uncle was just trying to, like, get more of his ice cream from him. I thought that sums up the main character and the relationship between him and his uncle perfectly.
I love it. That one got past me somehow, but I like it anyway. Here's a little bit of a more serious one. So this is obviously because of the idea of the book. There's a lot of time spent thinking about him becoming a werewolf and how much he's excited about it. And I talked a little bit about that earlier. And this is just him kind of realizing more what it means to Darren and Libby if he were to become a werewolf, and what it means to himself. When you're a kid, facts don't matter. It's how hard you believe, how much you wish. For Darren, shifting that first time, it was a dream come true. For Libby, it was the nightmare starting. So they're kind of thinking about, like, their... And he's thinking about how they reacted to becoming werewolves themselves, and I think there's definitely, you know, shadows of that in how they feel about our main character becoming a werewolf. So that's pretty cool. And then I've just got a couple of tough guy ones to end off with. So you have any more, Olivia's?
I do, actually.
Go for it.
Can I just say, though, first that I love that quote that you just did, and it plays into kind of a theme throughout the book where saying things might make them be.
Yeah.
So some of it is his uncle just yelling answers at game shows.
Yelling it true.
Yeah. So great stuff there. Darren had never taken one single hour of geometry in his whole stupid life, but he knew about the shortest distance between two points. He knew where I was, and that's Darren coming to save him at one particular part, but I thought that was just worded beautifully. Yeah,
that is really good. I'm going to do two quick ones just to wrap up my quotes. I had about 30 total, so this is way less than... But I actually marked down the ones I wanted the most this time, so I didn't have to go searching like an idiot like I always do. Just a couple of more of like tough guy kind of quotes to round things out. The first one, I would have cried, except I'm a werewolf. And that's kind of a theme throughout, is at these challenging and hard or sad moments, he always... It's more like he's telling himself than remembering being told. Werewolves don't cry. So I like that line a lot. And then just, again, kind of like the hero worship of his uncle Darren. I really like this line a lot. Of the two things he wouldn't take from anybody, one was directions, the other was advice.
Great stuff right there.
Yeah.
I have three, and I'm going to narrow it down to two, but I don't even know how to rightly do that. So this one is just great. Long story short, the protagonist is he's watching somebody who's watching an RV, a recreational vehicle, an RV. There'd been a raccoon out there with me watching the RV as well, casing it like they do. I hissed at it to split, and it hissed back. Just wait, I told it in my head. Brilliant.
That's good stuff.
So I've got funny and I've got serious. We're going to go with funny, or maybe fitting. They come across another werewolf. I don't even know. I don't know if that's spoilery or not, but I think the quote gives it away. This time it was a werewolf. His hair was perfect.
Oh, I didn't know if you were going to get to that or not.
Yeah, it was between that and another one, and I was like, how else can you possibly close this out? Interesting story. I used to tell people when I was much younger that Warren Zevon song, Werewolves of London, mm-hmm. I would occasionally refer to it as the Romanian national anthem. I once told that to a girl, and she believed it.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's about London.
I know. That's the best part.
I mean, like, all right. She wasn't the sharpest.
No, she wasn't the sharpest werewolf in the pack. Why don't you go ahead and kick off wrap-ups?
Oh, man. Oh, it's London. All right, so before I start my wrap-up, I just want to point out that this is our seventh Stephen Graham Jones book review. And that's insane, considering we've only been doing this for 5 years. But Jones has come out with far more than seven books in the 5 years we've been doing this podcast. So we are actually kind of behind, even though that's a lot for one person. And he's got like 18 books. What does it say in his bio? It didn't say. Oh, he's written like 18 books or something like that. It's crazy. So it's obvious that we're fans of Stephen Graham Jones. You know that we know him personally and everything like that. But there's no bias in these reviews because he's a damn good writer. I've liked everything I've read by Stephen, and I think that he has such an obvious love for whatever topic it is, love and curiosity for whatever topic it is that he's tackling, that when he does it right. Werewolves, werewolves appear in his bio, so this is probably one of the more front and center ones. Like, he did Not for Nothing, which was a detective novel, and that was more so that I remember him saying something about how he wanted to understand how a detective novel works, so he wrote one, which is just blows my mind. But werewolves, I know, are a much more passionate topic of his, and he just did it so well. I like the coming-of-age approach. I like the kind of fractured timeline. I think that lends well to keeping us kind of guessing as well and feeling transient, because there was a whole thing about this book is you were never in one place for too long, and we felt like we were never in one kind of age for too long. So I think that suited the way that the story was told. And I love how much you got into this, like I said before, like a verbal history, like a spoken history of werewolves, because that's all they ever had. And I don't know, the tone of the book was great. It was so emotional. Like, there was a lot of, it was this kid's life and all the uncertainties and all the good things and bad things that are happening to you when you're in your teens and stuff like that. But just kind of wrapped up in a weird, kind of goofy, funny, but sometimes very serious werewolf story. Really gory stuff happens, really serious stuff happens, funny stuff happens. So it's your typical Stephen Graham Jones book, and it's just really well done. I can't think of another, rating I would give it besides 5 stars.
Right. Seventh Stephen Graham Jones book. And as I look at the titles, no two are even remotely like the other ones. I mean, one of them's a collection, so I mean that's kind of a little different, but all of them, I don't want to say different genres, but yeah, in some cases, and even different genres. This one definitely felt like it was close to his heart, and maybe he's fooling us. I mean, Rob mentioned werewolves are in his bio, but there's a part in the book. Here's my attachment to werewolves. There's a part in the book where a character has done some research on how to become a werewolf. And I remember being in probably seventh or eighth grade and trying to find out how I could become a werewolf. And I'm willing to bet that Stephen Graham Jones did the same thing at some point. As a matter of fact, some of that information may have come from the same weird occult book I was able to find because it all sounded very familiar. So I've had an affection for werewolves since I was a little kid. This is the consummate book on werewolves. The Last Werewolf was a great book and it was a great story for what it was, but this one addresses the everyday needs of today's werewolf, I guess, and it's done brilliantly. We could probably spend half an hour talking about the little quirks and things, about what, French fries. We talked about trash cans, and there's a variety of other things that come up in the book. But this is definitely someone who really, really cares about this topic, writing about it. Although I mentioned I would have liked to have seen a more linear novel. I'm sticking by that. This was still brilliant in the way it was told and very engaging. And I highly doubt that anybody who reads this and that encounters werewolves in fiction, hopefully, or movies or whatever, will be able to not immediately use this as a frame of reference if they want to or not. It of the books of the seven, and the only Stephen Graham Jones books I've read are the ones we've reviewed on here. This definitely felt to be the most polished. All the other ones, I almost think I could have read them and thought Stephen Graham Jones, Stephen Graham Jones. This one had a little bit different. It had a little more polish on it, and it is probably why we'll see this to be a little more mainstream, I think. I really there's other than the vignettes and stuff, there's nothing I can find wrong with this book. And even with my little gripe about that, I still think it's a 5-star book.
Excellent.
All right. Not a lot else going on this week, but we do want to say our friend Paul Tremblay, Bram Stoker award-winning Paul Tremblay is now how we're going to have to refer to him, rightfully so. I know he was nominated for The Little Sleep, but that was like 10 years ago, which just being nominated is a huge honor. But he took that shit home over the weekend.
He literally, I'm guessing, literally took it home because he's probably back home now.
I don't think he was there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I watched some of that. First of all, this is the second year in a row where they apparently have trouble with what time that starts.
Oh, no, seriously?
You tune in at the starting time, and it doesn't actually come on until like half an hour later. And I got to tell you, man, I don't know if we'll ever be at the Stoker Awards. There's some boring shit happening right there.
Was the live stream a problem? I didn't watch it this year because I knew the live stream was so terrible last year.
No, it was. No, the streaming itself was okay.
Just, it was the awards. The awards.
Yeah. It was a little rough, man.
Awards equals boring.
Now, I will say that I don't know if this is, more congratulations are due to Paul for this, but Stephen King, who had tweeted about how the book scared the hell out of him a couple of months ago, tweeted to congratulate him, and I'll read you that tweet. Congratulations to Paul Tremblay, who just won the Stoker Award for A Head Full of Ghosts. Told you it was good. That's got to be almost as cool as getting the Stoker Award, I'd have to imagine.
Stephen King just made the Stoker Award look like second place in something, I guess. Yeah. I'm guessing, right?
Yeah, I can only, I can't, I can't even really imagine what it'd be like. I mean, regardless of who Paul's favorite horror author is, I mean, Stephen King, that's it. You don't get bigger than that. It's like God himself congratulating you on something.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, congratulations, Paul. Our piddly little congratulations, comparatively, at least, to Stephen King. Well deserved, sir. Well deserved.
Yeah, great book. Looking forward to Disappearance of Devil's Rock, which is coming up next month.
Thought you were going to say A Head Fuller of Ghosts or something, the sequel.
A Head More Full of Ghosts.
Yes. Yeah, so we definitely we have copies of that. this time to be fair, from the publisher.
Yeah.
Which is cool, which is really the way it should be. Listen, writers, if you're listening, you've got a resource here. You've got guys who review books. We shouldn't have to chase them down. I swear to God, I see guys, I'm like, I've never seen this person ever review a book, but there they are with an arc of something and a picture next to them, and it drives me goddamn crazy.
All right, but I thought I changed your tone on this, because I think I made a very valid point in the past. I don't know if it was on or off the podcast, but they probably asked for them. And that's why they've got them. No,
you did mention that, and yes, you're right. They probably did.
We don't ask for stuff.
It didn't change my opinion.
All right. Well, I'm just gonna. Well, I made that. Then obviously, my next choice was I'm going to request for books separately for both of us. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking on your behalf.
Yeah.
And it's been working so far. We're getting books now.
Yeah. Hachette Books sent us book three in some kind of weird science fiction fantasy fucking trilogy.
No, we got this one, The Disappearance of Devil's Rock. I know. Soul Standard.
I couldn't even understand how that Hachette book came out.
I don't get that either.
I'm still just really confused by it, but we're not reviewing that, by the way. I don't know if I mentioned it. I am nixing.
That's all right. You're Nixon?
Nixon
in China? Isn't that a thing?
I don't know. I have no idea. But speaking of China, it's not Nixon in China. It's McRae in China.
Yeah, our buddy.
Yeah, Ryan is in China doing undisclosed stuff for 3 months.
Undisclosed.
Undisclosed stuff, because he didn't really say what he was doing very specifically. But he is traveling for work. All I know is, all I heard from Ryan is, I don't know, I'll talk to you in 3 months, I don't know what internet's like, I don't know if I'll be able to use the internet, blah, blah, blah. And apparently in China, you're only allowed to use the internet 42 times a day to post pictures of the fact that you're in China, with things saying like, oh, look at how boring this is, and then, you know, he's standing in the middle of, I don't know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail or something, I don't know, whatever. Something to show off how he's in China. So I have now reported him to the Chinese authorities repeatedly. So if you've been seeing stuff on the internet from Ryan, won't be for long. He'll probably be arrested and hung.
The Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Yeah.
That's probably where it was. Yeah, I'm guessing that's actually where he was. Yeah, China's not slowing that guy down, because I have gotten a ton of text messages from him and pictures and stuff on social media. Apparently the only thing you can do in China is use the internet.
Not much longer, I'm telling you. Some of the things I've reported in the Chinese before. So we're going to need a new intern, man.
Oh, no. You're like, he's taking pictures in bathrooms.
Yeah, and then you know what? I got to tell you, I did see a little bit of rice in one picture, so that's fair. I have not seen him with any cheap electronics. There are no cheap electronics anywhere to be seen.
Well, I mean, I don't want to reveal where he works, but I would be very surprised if there were cheap electronics.
Well, listen, there's probably copies of the electronics from where he works available for 1/10 the price. It's made by the same 6-year-olds.
Oh, damn. Yeah. All right. Ho Chi Minh Trail.
I'm wondering if he's actually using what he learned from me about how to stop the suicide jumpers. Just moving them all to the first floor. He's implementing that while he's there in China.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm guessing that's... You're a fucking crazy man.
Rob informed me before the podcast that China has the most population.
I'm guessing.
Our country.
Yeah.
And we decided that all they're doing is fucking over there. So I don't know what Ryan's doing specifically.
But he was sent over as population control in general.
Oh, well, there you go, then.
He's trying to stop the people from killing themselves, but also stopping them from having so much sex. It's a really weird...
Oh, well, you have to balance it out, right? Yeah. Because if one less dies, you've got to bring one less into the world. I understand now. Yeah. China, is China... No, no joking aside, isn't China the country where you're limited to having one child?
There was in the past a
longer
thing, and I believe that that no longer exists.
Yeah, you're gonna be ramping up production on televisions.
All right. Well, congrats for getting to China safely, Ryan. And if you're listening to this,
yeah, glad you made it, buddy.
If you're listening to this, let us know how accurate Livius is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I nailed all of that.
Did I tell you that I'm a YouTube sensation?
No, not at all. Where can I find out more about this?
I appeared in a testimonial video for This Is Horror's Patreon page.
Very interesting. I saw that. There were quite a number of people, including Stephen Graham Jones, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he was the first on the video, and I was the second.
Honest with you. I didn't make it much past you two.
Yeah, you really don't have to tune in for much more than that. They were front-loading that one. They did not bury the lead.
The heavy hitters were at the beginning there. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought it was a very interesting thing to do. I'm a little sad that we didn't think of it first.
Hey, it's the one thing we didn't think of first.
This is true. Because, you know, I did see that now you can listen to This Is Horror on YouTube.
Yeah.
I saw that.
That's interesting. Yeah, with their latest episode, right?
Yep. I saw there was a post about it. I don't know if it was the one that's coming up or if they've already put one out, but I did see something about it online.
Yeah, they got one up. Yeah, sounds like something we did recently.
Listen, even though you can listen to our podcast on YouTube, I don't fucking understand why you would. I'll be really honest in front. I think we should be there. But I really don't understand. If you're on YouTube, why aren't you just on iTunes or Stitcher or the website? Like, I don't understand the point, but apparently other people are doing it, so
yeah,
we should be too.
Yep. So if you want to see 26 seconds of me talking about why This Is Horror is great, you can watch the first like minute and 10 seconds of that video. It's like 8 minutes long. It's too much, but me and Steven say some good stuff, and then you can just kind of head over to the booked YouTube and watch me talk about something else. I don't know.
Oh, and in case you missed it earlier, we did two. Rob, what do you think? 10, 12 minutes of spoiler talk about this episode, about this book about mongrels over on our Patreon. That's accessible to you if you are a contributor at the $5 level per month. So if you're at $2 or $3, just up that a little bit. If you're not a contributor at all, well, why not? So go support your favorite podcast. Assuming that's us, and if not, just support us. Patreon.com/booked. We appreciate you guys.
Yeah, and we're getting dangerously close to the t-shirt level, which I believe is, if you're pledging $10 or more a month, you get our t-shirt once we hit the $225 per month goal. And we're very close. We're like less than $20 a month away from that, so we could be making t-shirts very soon. I'm dying for it.
And I'm going to thank you guys who aren't contributing, because I have not had to do the work in getting the t-shirts made, which I thought was going to be in, February? And here it is, creeping up on June.
I'm going to say, though, that I might have to up the ante at some point and just decide to start walking around shirtless until we start getting more Patreon money.
I thought you were going to say you were just going to donate money to Patreon to get the shirts made. I was like, that's not how this works.
I won't do that. I'm not crazy.
All right, next week, interlude episode coming up, and I feel kind of comfortable in saying that maybe before you hear an interlude, there might be just kind of like a YouTube hangout happening.
Kind of comfortable, yeah, depending on how quickly you get that room set up.
That's very true. So my booked studio has been under construction for, I don't know, 2 months now, mostly because I'm way too lazy to move all the shit around in there to get it set back up. So this podcast is coming to you live from bed, basically. So, I did have someone else tell me today. So you guys meet up somewhere and do that? And I was like, oh, no, we've only ever been in the same place like 3 times and in the same room only twice doing this.
Yeah.
People do still think we sit across the table staring lovingly at one another while we do this podcast, which is awesome. I love that we can pull that off for people.
Yeah. To be fair, I am staring lovingly at that Christmas picture that you sent us that one year.
Of course you are. I am. I'm staring at the screen.
You're watching K-pop.
I'm watching K-pop.
Or K-dramas. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So Rob earlier, this wasn't on the podcast. He goes, oh, hey, I got to send you this text message. Do you have your phone close to you? I was like, how else do you think I get through this podcast? So, yeah, I've got my phone close to me. That's how it works. All right. Until next time, I'm Livius Nedden.
And I'm Rob Olson. Keep reading.